Hello, and welcome to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 22nd of September 2018. Now, in last month's News Extra, you heard Rob's voice instead of mine. This was because he and Liz-Anne kindly stepped in and covered for me while I was away on holiday, riding my motorbike around Scandinavia. So, many thanks to them. And in fact, Liz-Anne is also helping me here today, so thanks again to her. So, back to normal. And in this programme, we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from this week's Hearts Advertiser, and the stories have been selected by Liz-Anne. We'll also have our selection of some good bits of national radio coming up in the next few days. After that, we have another in our series of Community Matters interviews with a local volunteer group. Then we have another in-concert feature, highlighting some of the musical performances coming up in the next few weeks. Today's music is called Forgotten Blues and is by Goffby. So, we start with the news, and our readers today are Elaine, Guy, Anne and Anna.
Hello, I'm Elaine and this is my first article. 11th hour bid to build 160 homes on Meadow. A house building company which has been trying to build stables on a protected meadow, has asked for consideration in the St Albans local plan. Bedmond Field, of Bedmond Lane, St Albans, has been listed as an asset of community value, ACV, since 2014, and owners, Calla Homes, recently put in yet another application to allow horses to graze in the meadow, despite repeated rejections. Now, with less than a month to go until the local plan consultation ends on Wednesday, October the 17th, Calla Homes is asking St Albans Council to consider the field for residential development. Working with Hightown Housing Association, Calla intends to bring forward a scheme to build up to 160 new homes, of which 50% will be affordable housing. Both Calla Homes and Hightown claim to have been affected by an emotional plea by Councillor Mary Maynard at the Council's Planning Policy Committee in June, where she stated the importance of the local plan meeting, the need of low-income families, so they are not priced out of the district. The meadow was previously found suitable for residential development for 110 new homes in the Strategic Housing Land Availability Assessment, and Calla does not intend to put the site up for sale before its ACV status ends in March 2019, or for the foreseeable future. A statement from Calla Homes said, as part of the meadow's future development, Calla will be offering a proportion as public open space. As such, the residential development of the site will not only produce much needed housing, of which a large proportion will be aimed specifically for young families in a highly sustainable location, but also a long-term benefit in terms of publicity, accessible open space. As such, the residential development of the site will not only produce much needed housing, of which a large proportion will be aimed specifically for young families in a highly sustainable location, but also a long-term benefit in terms of publicly accessible open space. Timothy Beechcroft, chair of Verulam Residents Association, said, "It's not a surprise that they have put this forward. They've always said they wanted to build on the field. There's less than a month for this to happen, which isn't very long to respond to the proposal. Clearly there's a need for affordable housing, which the proposal includes, but 160 houses on the site is more than has ever been proposed for it before."
Well, hello, my name's Guy, and I'm going to start with something from the Hearts-Ads opinion columns, which follows on directly to the last reader, so there will be a little repetition, I'm sure you'll forgive us. The immediate reaction in the Hearts-Ads offices after seeing Calla Homes' bid to develop Bedmond Red Meadow was to laugh. Just a few weeks after I used this column to warn that there was no chance of the developer giving up on its plans to slap a load of houses on the site, they have fulfilled these predictions in spades. claiming to have been inspired by Councillor Mary Maynard's emotional speech about the need for affordable housing, made in June, the company feels it's on some sort of moral crusade to help those on incomes too low to afford homes in the district. How very noble of them. Perhaps it was really their motive for the proposed scheme that they might like to put their hands in their pockets and give a low-income family a deposit from their share of the substantial profits should this succeed. Make no mistake, this is about money, as it always is. Carla have been trying to develop the site for years and have used this opportunity of the coming consultation of the local plan to engineer this eventuality. One does have to ask why they waited so long to put the land forward for development, instead of answering the earlier call for sites or even speaking in the wake of Councillor Maynard's apparently influential speech, rather than waiting for 3 months later. To make matters worse, the company is proposing to build even more homes than ever previously contemplated, suggesting 160 instead of the 110 considered in the past. Let us hope the St Albans District Council see this exercise for what it is, a shallow and desperate attempt to develop a site which is recognised as an asset of community value, despite Carla's various court challenges, and throws out the proposal like yesterday's dishwater.
Hello, my name is Anne. A group of travellers have set up a camp behind a leisure centre in London Coney. The travellers pitched around 21 caravans on Thursday behind Cotlands Wick Leisure Centre in High Street. St Albans Council solicitor Charles Turner said two traveller groups set up an unauthorised camp last Thursday and on the council's open space at Cotlands Wick. We immediately began the legal process to remove them, and we obtained an order from St Albans Magistrates Court today instructing them to leave the site. A bailiff is now serving this on the travellers, who will then have 24 hours to leave. In the meantime, our officers have been talking to the travellers about their responsibilities, and the police have also visited the scene. We have a team on standby, ready to inspect the site after the travellers' departure and carry out any clearing up that may be necessary. A Hearts Police spokesman said police are aware of travellers currently in the recreational ground in the High Street, London Coney. The local Safer Neighbourhood team are liaising with both the travellers and the local council in order to monitor the situation. London Coney councillor Simon Calder said, "I know there was some disruption at the football game on Saturday. I had a couple of calls from residents who were concerned." Last year in London Coney, we had 5 or 6 incursions. I don't know how we're going to deal with it. Parish Councillor Drida Gordon said, "There have been travellers on this site before and the district councillor needs to secure the site and stop this happening again." I'm on London Coney Parish Council and we've had similar situations and we've made sure that there are railings up to stop any further incursions onto our land. The council were putting in the security because there was an important football match at the weekend and they didn't want any disruption. People were able to come and go despite the 21 caravans being in situ. The same group had tried to go into parish council land up at White Horse Lane, but fortunately the parish grounds staff parked on the land to block their entrance.
Hello, I'm Anna, and this piece is also about homes planning. And it's entitled Homes Over Rail Freight on Greenbelt Site. St Albans MP Anne Main reveals why she is supporting the district's new local plan and is in favour of building homes instead of a rail freight depot on the former Radlett airfield. "I welcome the fact that the new local plan is making progress and is now out for consultation. We currently have one of the oldest district plans in the country. We need a new plan to meet growing housing need and to shape St Albans for the future. One site being taken forward is the Park Street Garden Village. This greenbelt site was targeted by developers for a strategic rail freight interchange. However, I believe that if this site is to be lost to development, then it should be used to develop much needed homes. I have campaigned for 14 years against this site being used as an SRFI, I believe there would be major pressures on our roads to commuter services if SRFI was built. The Garden Village proposal in the local plan offers us a creditable alternative for the site. Doing nothing is not an option. We have to choose between supporting a disruptive rail interchange or a new Garden Village with the infrastructure and schooling improvements that it would bring. If this site cannot be used for housing, then an alternative site will still have to be found to meet our housing need. This could mean more greenbelt loss, and we would have a rail freight terminal. As you will see in the local plan, the Garden Village site will require a developer to provide around 2,300 new homes, with almost half being affordable housing. It will include a nursing or residential home and a facility to care for those with special needs, in addition to green areas and a new country park. There will also be two new primary schools and a secondary school built as part of the plan. The plan will also include upgrades to the Abbey railway line and new connections to Euston. Two things that many commuters have asked for years. This site will be developed. We need to ensure it's done in the best interests of St Albans residents. I would like to see it developed for the homes and schools my constituents need.
Village's school bus is axed with little warning. Children living in Redbourne have been left without a means of getting to school after their bus service was cancelled. Delphine Ioannou says her 16-year-old son was waiting for the 657 bus to go to the first day of term at St George's School in Harpenden when a bus driver stopped and told him the 657 had been cancelled. According to bus company Uno's website, the 657 does not serve Redbourne as of August 26th. Delphine of Bettesbol Meadows said, "They did not really tell us in advance. They did not even put up a sign at the bus stop. The only way my son can get home is walking down the Nicky line, which is very isolated, and he does not always walk with other people. Sometimes there's a cyclist or someone walking a dog, but it's not lit, and come the winter it's going to be very dark. We rely on public transport, and people are encouraged to use it. Yet the actual service around Redbourne is very poor. They do not turn up or they are late. I feel there is not enough public transport in Redbourne." Delphine knows of several other younger children who have been affected by this change. Her and the other parents have been supporting each other with lifts, but worry that this is not a long-term fix. When she contacted Uno's customer officer, David Love, he told her the decision had been made on a commercial basis. Managing Director of Uno Buses, James Thorpe, said, "From the end of August, we combined our 657 and 658 services and started the new route at Harpenden. We reduced the route because of the low numbers of people using the extensions to Redbourne, which meant the route was no longer commercially viable, as it isn't subsidised by council funding. However, the Sunday extensions to Redbourne, which are funded by the council, continue to operate as normal. It's unfortunate to hear of the inconvenience to passengers. However, we notified passengers of the change 3 weeks prior with notices on buses and on our website. In July, the Hearts Advertiser reported that the 34-35 centre bus service, which also serves Redbourne, had been cut back because St Albans Council and Hearts County Council had cut their subsidies for the bus route.
Well, this piece has a picture of a huge aircraft flying in a blue sky, and you can probably guess what the piece is going to be about. Failing that, the heading is "Luton Airport says fewer complaints received about noise from planes." Noise complaints from planes flying to and from Luton Airport have fallen since this time last year, according to a quarterly monitoring report. London Luton Airport's, that's LLA, latest report shows that there were 2,335 noise complaints in the second quarter of 2018, a 44% decrease from the 5,304 complaints in the second quarter of 2017. Of the complaints over the past 3 months, 53% were made by 10 individuals. The number of new complaints has fallen from 280 this time last year to 152. In the same period, 4.45 million passengers travelled through the airport, compared to 4.29 million last year, with 36,000 flights using the airport in total. Additional noise restrictions were put in place from June the 1st, which included refusing any non-emergency flight diversions, refusing ad hoc flights during the night, and preventing the operators from rescheduling daytime flights to nighttime. These restrictions, which are intended to reduce noise reduction to residents, will be in place until the end of September. Flight operations manager James Dunter said, LLA is a busy and successful airport which brings huge profits to the local community, but also means that noise from aircraft is inevitable. We're always looking for new ways to reduce noise, and working with the local community is a really important part of this. We're pleased that our airline partners are also committing to noise reduction by introducing the next generation aircraft over the next few years. However, Andrew Lamborn, for anti-noise campaign group LADACAN, Luton and District Association for the Control of Aircraft Noise, said, "What a lot of spin. The aircraft is now officially in breach of the planning condition governing noise at night, which provides it's got noisier. It's likely that there was a spike in complaints last year as people registered their annoyance with the concentration of aircraft tracks while the Civil Aviation Authority was assessing the effects of that change. We would certainly welcome more quarter-engined aircraft than the current 2%, but sadly 50% less noise does not mean that sound half as loud, it just sounds slightly quieter." Luton Airport will hold its next noise surgery for Redbourne residents on Thursday, September the 27th at Redbourne Parish Centre, The Park, AL3 7LR, from 4pm to 7pm.
Stepping back in time for inaugural Vintage Festival. That's the headline. The streets of St Albans were transported back in time to the 20th century this weekend. Thousands of people enjoyed activities, vintage cocktails, live music and historic vehicles lining the streets for St Albans Time Turn Festival. Different roads were themed. Hollywell Hill was World War I and the 1920s. St Peter's Street became World War II and the 1940s. George Street was the 1950s and 60s. And Catherine Street, which was closed to traffic, was the 1970s and 1980s. Hundreds of children took part in a history trail around the city centre, and one lucky entrant will win a £50 St Albans gift card. The event was organised by St Albans BID as part of Heritage Open Days. BID manager Harold Burridge said, "The city has never seen anything like this before. Encouraging the public away from the main streets and into the other areas was great fun, drawing attention to the personality and passion of all our businesses." She said they are looking forward to making this a flagship event. And there are two pictures here of people dancing in the street.
Confident and electrifying start to new season at the Abbey Theatre. Madeleine Burton reviews Butterflies Are Free, Company of Ten's first production of the new season at the Abbey Theatre. Electrifying performances by two Company of Ten debutantes have got the new season at the Abbey Theatre off to a flying start. Matt Hughes Short and Lily Prowse play the young couple who live in adjoining apartments in 1972 New York in Butterflies Are Free, a bittersweet comedy by Leonard Gersh. So far, so straightforward. But it soon becomes clear that Don Baker, the role taken by Matt, is blind and has been since birth. And that is the crux of Butterflies Are Free, a play that pits the newly independent Don against Lily's character, the commitment-phobic would-be actress Jill. The play is a delight from beginning to end and has reached its denouement. You could have heard a pin drop in the Abbey Theatre auditorium, so intense was the scene and the quality of the acting. To play the role of a blind man is no mean achievement, and Matt carries it off superbly, able to rise above his handicap in witty and endearing style. Don measures out distances around his flat and the nearby shops. When his world falls apart and he becomes disorientated and falls, the full extent of his desire to live an independent life away from his overbearing mother comes into sharp focus. Even in the most dramatic moments, Matt shows the difficulties faced by a blind mind with both comedy and pathos. It takes real talent to do that. Lily, as the 19-year-old divorcee, Jill Tanner, is his equal, even though hers is the more conventional role. The couple spark off each other in every way, and Lily has the vocal clarity and stage presence to make her a welcome addition to the company of ten. Taking the other two roles are Beverly Robley as Mrs. Baker, Don's mum, who is a real hyacinth bouquet until Jill's words make her see the light. And it's always good to see John Pike back on the Abbey Theatre stage, here taking the role of seedy theatre director Ralph Austin. Sally Davis directs Butterflies Are Free with confidence and care. It never becomes mawkish, and every little detail is spot on. It runs until Saturday the 22nd, and tickets can be obtained from the box office on 01727 857 861.
Clean Sweep. Zero schools in district take up offer of free anti-idling signs. No school in St Albans responded to an offer of free anti-idling signs where their pupils congregate. In 2017, St Albans District Council, SADC, sent letters to all 39 schools and nurseries in the area, asking if they would like a free sign encouraging drivers to switch off their engines when stationary. This is part of a bid to reduce pollution in areas where children gather, as toxins in the air are especially harmful to young people. Pollution can contribute to respiratory illness, cancer and premature deaths. However, SADC's Community Environment and Sports Scrutiny Committee heard earlier this month that none of the schools responded. The council is now planning to make a second engagement attempt, prioritising seven schools around the congested Peahen Junction. There are already nine notices at idling hotspots, including near Romeland Hill, Westminster Lodge Coach Park, the Civic Centre, several taxi ranks and Batchwood Nightclub. Councillor Anthony Rowlands, the committee's chair, said, "There was a near unanimous feeling that the sign should be put up as a matter of urgency. There is a particular problem of engine idling at schools during pick-up and drop-off times, when parents sometimes sit for long periods in their car with the motor running. I hope that the schools will take up the offer of the signs, as some have been slow to do so in the past." Portfolio holder for the Environment, SADC, Councillor Francis Leonard, will consider the signage proposals before they are approved. After the meeting, the committee heard that air quality is now being monitored at eight new locations in St Albans District, adding to 43 locations already audited. A St Albans school spokesperson said they had no record of receiving a letter, adding, "However, I can share that as St Albans School sits in the conservation area and our exterior wall outside our main entrance is of historical importance, we are not permitted to attach any signage to its surface." Other priority schools in the city centre, Aboyne Lodge School, Abbey CEVA's Primary School, Abbey View Nursery and Preschool, Auburn City School and St Peter's School, were contacted for comment but either declined or failed to respond. Harts County Council said it was up to individual schools to respond.
The heading I have here is, "Does change to street lights switch on times go far enough?" Harts County Council could be set to tweak its street lights policy, but opposition councillors have insisted it has still not gone far enough. Critics previously claimed that the current approach, which sees lights turned off at midnight, has contributed to rising crime, although the link has been dismissed by police chiefs. However, the local authority's Highway and Environment Cabinet panel last week agreed to recommend progressively dimming the lights from 9 p.m. before turning them off at 1 a.m. They would also come on at 5 a.m, an hour earlier than at present, and remain lit until dawn. Liberal Democrat councillors who oppose the part-night lighting policy claimed the extension falls far short, but their counter-proposal to keep lights on until 2 a.m. was rejected. County Councillor Nigel Quinton said, "It's extremely depressing that the Conservative-led County Council remains so resistant to sensible and proportional attempts to improve things locally for our residents. Those arriving late at night at our railway stations or working night shifts at the QE2 want to be able to walk along lit street." HCC began the move over the LED lighting in 2014 as part of a drive to cut costs and reduce energy consumption, with around 67,000 units already replaced. The 1 a.m. change has already been piloted around the country, although not in the St Albans district. Councillor Robin Parker, who represents Chells in Stevenage, said officers have not yet said how much it would cost to keep low-level lighting on all night. Some residents have claimed LED lights level are worse than the traditional sodium lights, but according to the panel's report, dimming LEDs can make an area appear brighter because of their light distribution. Officers wrote, "The panel members that attended the sites commented on the contrast between the light and dark patches appeared to be not so harsh. They hardly noticed the change when the dimming occurred and were satisfied that they could see and be seen when the lights were dimmed by 80%. The recommendation to adopt the change will be put to the County Council's Cabinet next month.
The headline is "Underground World War II Shelters to be filled with concrete to avoid catastrophic accident." Historic air raid shelters in Harpenden are being filled with cement following safety concerns. A structural survey of four underground bunkers concluded they were a catastrophic risk to public safety under well-used pedestrian routes. There are two under Leighton Green, one by the Sensory Garden on Bowes Parade and one under Queen's Road. Work to pour aerated concrete into the shelter hatches started earlier this week and will continue for about 2 weeks. This technique has been chosen to cause the least harm to the environment. Projects and Community Manager at Harpenden Town Council, HTC, Philip Wright, said this has been forced upon us for safety reasons and it isn't something we would have chosen. The person who did the structural survey indicated that any renovations would be cost prohibited. That is to say, it would be cost too much to preserve it. In order to save the history, HTC has created 3D scans of the underground shelters, which will be available to view online. There will also be information boards erected at Leighton Green and Bowes Parade about the shelters and World War II. A letter was sent to Harpenden residents notifying them of the work. It read, "The survey showed that structures have deteriorated significantly and are a catastrophic risk to public safety. HTC has commissioned ProCare Construction to fill the shelters in," adding, "ProCare will endeavour to minimise their impact on the local area, instructing all contractors of the importance of observing parking and access arrangements, particularly for the closest neighbours." According to the Harpenden District Local History Society, excavation work on the Bowes Parade shelter started just 9 days before the then Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain declared war with Germany in September 1939. It was built in a dog-leg shape with 6 10-yard lengths connected by 90-degree corners, using reinforced concrete for the walls and roof. There were wooden benches and chemical Elsan-type toilets behind sackcloth modesty screens for the comfort of 180 people who could fit inside. HTC ensured the shelters were completely empty before the work began on Monday.
A disabled man has been stuck blocking vital hospital beds for weeks because social services cannot care for him at home. Richard Cubis was in chronic pain for 3.5 years while he waited for a kneecap replacement surgery appointment, which kept on being cancelled last minute. The operation finally went ahead after the Hearts ad ran his story in August and it was picked up by national news. However, since having the operation, the 69-year-old has not been allowed to return to his Marshallswick home because Hearts County Council Social Services are concerned they can no longer fulfil his needs. He felt well enough to come home within a week of his operation about 3 weeks ago. Richard said, within 5 or 6 days of having the operation, it felt good, only a bit painful. But I think the government should damn well put some more money in social services. I feel very bitter about it because I am paying rent on my flat, but not living there because social services say I can't use it without it getting adequate fittings to make my life easier. I feel very bitter, almost enraged. Before the operation, carers came to look after Richard 4 times a day. He added, I'd be over the moon if I could go home. Don't get me wrong, the staff here are lovely. I couldn't wish for better people, and everyone is marvellous, but there is a black hole which is social services. Bed blocking, or delayed transfer of care, DTOC, is defined by the NHS when a patient is ready to leave hospital but is still occupying a bed which could be put to better use. According to independent healthcare improvement charity, the King's Fund, the proportion of DTOCs due to social care has risen steeply since 2014. However, 58% of delays in 2016-17 are still attributed to the NHS. A spokesperson for HCC, who administer adult social services around the county, said there have been concerns about whether the staff at the FlexiCare sheltered housing scheme where Mr. Cubis lives can manage the level of care which he requires. We are therefore working closely with all concerned, not only to get him home as soon as possible, but also to ensure that he gets the right support for his needs. And there's a picture of him at home before his operation in a wheelchair and looking quite miserable.
School's new all-weather pitch aiming to encourage girls and under 14s into football. A new all-weather pitch at a school in Harpenden aims to double the number of girls playing football. The third generation 3G artificial grass pitch was officially opened at Roundwood Park School on Thursday. Former Arsenal striker Alan Smith attended the ribbon-cutting ceremony alongside England international player Natasha Dowie, Paralympic five-a-side footballer David Clark and Harpenden MP Bim Afolomani. To fund the pitch, the school received a £500,000 grant from the Premier League and the FA Facilities Fund, allowing them to replace the existing grass pitch, which was unsuitable for football due to poor drainage and the inability to withstand harsh weather conditions. The new pitch will be used by players from the school as well as Harpenden Colts FC, who operate 60 teams across 8 different training venues. Roundwood Park worked alongside the Football Foundation and Hertfordshire County FA to create a 5-year football development plan for the site. More than 1,250 people are expected to take part in sports on the pitch, with 730 new under-14s using the pitch over the next 5 years and a 240% increase in the number of girls playing football. Natasha Dowie, who left Roundwood Park 12 years ago, said, I hope to see more professional players, both male and female, coming from Roundwood Park. David Clark said he predicted the pitch would be an incredible success, and head of PE Matt Hunter said he hoped more girls would be encouraged to play football. Watford FC Community Sports and Education Trust also plan to use the pitch to deliver weekly sessions for female and disabled football, as well as regular summer holiday coaching and coach education workshops. Roundwood Park School Business Manager Tony Smith said, to see the transformation of an old and tired muddy field into a world-class facility, which we now have the privilege to use, is a great achievement, not only for the school, but for all those who have been involved in the process. My thanks go to the Premier League and the FA Facilities Fund, Harpenden Colts FC, and all of the My thanks go to the Premier League and the FA Facilities Fund, Harpenden Colts FC, and all of the parents of Roundwood Park School for making this day possible. And there's two lovely pictures of children enjoying the new pitch playing football.
Well, another happy comment now on the royal visit by the Countess of Wessex. A member of the royal family has visited the farm school in Harpenden. The Countess of Wessex dropped by Leaf Education Teenagers Engagement Day to meet the teenagers, some of whom were from St Albans schools, who were thinking issues such as linking farming to schools. Leaf Education's director, Carl Edwards, said, "Engaging young people in farming and food productivity is vitally important both to the future of the agricultural industry and to their own health and well-being." The event was all about listening to teenagers, hearing what their ideas were, finding out what issues matter most to them, and why they feel disconnected from farming and the outside world. "We've seen huge levels of engagement from everyone and been particularly impressed with their intelligent and imaginative ideas on how we, as an industry, can reach out to them more effectively."
Old Albanians saved their best until last to beat Barnes 33-24 in National League Two. An entertaining match proved somewhat frustrating for both sides, as neither could assert their authority on the other for long. But Albanians returned home with maximum points thanks to the excellent work from their three quarters, Al Glickston, Tom Bednall and Dan Watt. The trio were always slightly more precise in possession, ensuring slick distribution to their teammates. And this was emphasised by the two best tries of the game, which resulted from rapid passing, and once the ball had done the work, the two scorers, Peter Warne and Morgan Thompson, sped to the line without fuss. Discipline, as always, played a part, and the first quarter saw six penalties awarded against Barnes and just one to Albanians, with Bednall opening the scoring on 14 minutes after an indiscretion. However, the hosts took the lead at the end of this first period when Joel Vanderpool finished off a fine catch and drive move from a line-out and Charles Wicks converted. The next 10 minutes saw OAs take some temporary control when open side flanker George Bartlett was given an overlap on the left for Bednall to convert expertly, and then Alex Chalcroft announced his presence with an unconverted score. Barnes took the honours for the few remaining minutes in the half when loose head George Hunter and his substitute comrade William Simons both crossed in their best period of the day. Wicks converted Hunter's effort and his side were 4 points to the good at the break. However, Warren's excellent try followed 7 minutes after the restart, and Bednall's improvement and his smartly taken close range drop goal 3 minutes later gave Albanians the margin they needed. Barnes drew desperately close once more when Josh Davies broached a static OA's defence after a series of careless errors by the visitors, but opposite number Thompson finished off probably the best move of the match with 3 minutes to go. Ross Hamilton and Chris West were missing from this week's forward lineup, and OAs hoped the two stalwarts would be in contention this weekend for the battle against high-flying Rams at Woolhams, 3 p.m.
And another sports piece. Allinson urges Saints to make cup history. St Albans boss Ian Allinson is urging his men to write their names in the history books as he looks forward to their FA Cup second qualifying round tie with White Leaf at the weekend. Saints host the visitors from Sussex at Clarence Park on Saturday, and the well-respected manager is aiming for a cup run. Bostic Lee White Leaf edged past Saltdean United 2-1 in a replay after a 1-1 draw in the preliminary round, before triumphing over Corinthian Casuals by the same score after a 0 draw with the famous amateurs in the first qualifying round proper. And former Arsenal and Luton attacker Alisson, while stressing that he and his side are fully aware of the threat the visitors pose, is dreaming of progression in the world's oldest knockout tournament. Looking forward to the clash, Alisson said, "It will be a tough game. Whiteleaf deserve respect for reaching this stage. They're a very good young side and we're well aware of what they can do. The FA Cup is a magical competition, and I've told my squad they have a chance to write their names in the record books of this club. This stage is always exciting, and we're looking forward to the game, not least because there's more to come from my team." The National League South side sit in ninth position in the table, only a point behind seventh-placed Slough Town in the final playoff spot following an upturn in form after a stodgy start in the campaign. St Albans go into the eagerly awaited clash with Whiteleaf on the back of 2 wins on bounce after an impressive 4-2 victory at East Thurrock earlier this month was followed by a 2-0 win over Concord on Saturday. Modest Alisson, who reached the 1988 FK Cup semi-final with Luton before the Hatters lost to eventual winners Wimbledon at White Hart Lane, has not shared his memories of that run with his team. Nor has he told them about scoring in Arsenal's 3-1 defeat by Watford at Highbury in the 1987 quarter-finals. However, Alisson has told his men that they can make a name for themselves by playing well enough to beat Whiteleaf and embark on a run, a wish shared by everyone at the club. And there's a picture of David Noble celebrating scoring for St Albans City against Concord Rangers last weekend. He looks emphatic.
And that's the end of the news. And now the list of people whose deaths were announced this week. Thomas Archer, aged 83 years. Dennis Crabb, aged 97. Michael Cross, aged 87. Brian Gander, aged 91. Kathleen Knight, aged 91. Bridget Laver. David Meyrick, aged 88. Philip Setterfield, aged 92. Beryl Vuolo, aged 95. And Ronald White, aged 92. Now, another little bit of Forgotten Blues by Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of national radio highlights for the next few days.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights. And best-selling novelist Angela Carter features prominently on Radio 4 this week with a season of dramatisations of her work, entitled Get Carter. The season begins on Saturday the 22nd of September with the world premiere of an unmade screenplay, The Christchurch Murder, which Carter based on a real-life murder in Christchurch, New Zealand in 1954. It starts at 2:30 p.m. and stars Fiona Shaw. Over on Radio 3 at 3 p.m, you may prefer The Sound of Dance. Katie Durham, champion of the 2017 Strictly Come Dancing Christmas special, talks to Cuban dancer and choreographer Carlos da Costa about his 30-year career and the new company, Acosta Danza, which he set up following his retirement from classical ballet. At 8 p.m. on Radio 4, Archive on 4 explores the idea of character and whether it can be taught, drawing on archive recordings and discussion with academic experts. Then on Classic FM at 9 p.m. is a new series, Sounds and Sweet Airs, in which film and TV composer Debbie Wiseman celebrates female composers, beginning this week with Fanny Hensel, Mendelssohn's sister, Clara Schumann, Robert's wife, and Louise Farron and Lily Bullinger.
Now for Sunday the 23rd of September, and at 11:15 a.m. on Radio 4, is Desert Island Discs. This week's castaway with Kirsty Young is neurosurgeon Henry Marsh. Followed at 12 noon by the ever-popular Just a Minute with Nicholas Parsons and panellists Paul Merton, Giles Brandreth, Tony Hawkes and Zoe Lyons. More of Angela Carter at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 with a dramatisation of her novel Nights at the Circus. The fantastical story of Sophie Fevers, star of Music Hall, who claims to be part woman, part bird. Still with Radio 4 and at 5 p.m. on 4, looks at the world of Paralympics and allegations of athletes and coachings exaggerating the extent of their disability to cheat the classification system. Then at 7:15 on Radio 4, Bill Nighy stars as amateur sleuth Charles Paris in A Decent Interval, a dramatisation of the novel by Simon Brett. Finally, for Sunday 23rd September, more drama. Angela Carter again on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Two radio plays by Carter from the 1970s, introduced by Fiona Shaw as Angela Carter. First up is Vamparella, a young Englishman travelling through Transylvania, finds himself at the mercy of a lovely lady vampire and her governess. Followed by Come Unto These Yellow Shores, a hallucinatory drama about murderous Victorian painter Richard Dadd.
Look now at some of those programmes broadcast at the same time and the same day each week. The 15-minute drama each day on Radio 4 at 10:45 a.m. is The Bloody Chamber by, you've guessed it, Angela Carter. A set of fairy tales, this first one is the retelling of the story of Bluebeard, repeated each day at 7:45 p.m. At 12 noon on Radio 3, composer of the week is Russian Sergei Rachmaninoff, who lived in the States for 25 years from the end of the First World War to his death in 1943. Monday's programme examines his first concert tour of the States. At 1:45 p.m. on Radio 4 each day is a new series entitled Doorstep Daughter, the story of how two families, one Muslim, one Christian, came together to raise a baby in 1990s Watford. Finally, at 10:45 p.m. on Radio 4, this week's Book at Bedtime is The Silence of the Girls, Pat Barker's retelling of Homer's Iliad, one woman's journey through the chaos of the Trojan War.
We turn now to radio highlights for Monday, 24th of September. Start the week at 9 a.m. on Radio 4 features William Boyd discussing his new novel, Love is Blind, and Adina Jacobs, director of a new English National Opera production of Strauss's Salome. The drama at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4 is North. In 1939, the aviator Anne Morrow Lindbergh met writer Antoine de Saint-Juéry, forming a connection that would affect the rest of their lives, by Jennifer Schlatter and starring Samuel West. Followed at 3 p.m. by Counterpoint, the musical quiz hosted by Paul Gambaccini. Then at 4:30 p.m., also on Radio 4, The Digital Human investigates how little pieces of your personal information are constantly being uploaded into the digital world without you being aware of it. Over to Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. for tonight's concert by the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, featuring music inspired by Italy, Walton's Cello Concerto and Sibelius's Symphony No. 2 in D. Finally, at 11:30 p.m. on Radio 4, Making History This Week explores how jazz was brought to First World War trenches by African-American soldiers.
Moving on to Tuesday, the 25th of September, and in its final episode, celebrating the variety of the natural world, Natural Histories features the swan at 11 a.m. on Radio 4. The drama on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. is We're Back in Britain. David Morley's satire takes us back to the doom and gloom of Britain in the late 1960s. Still with Radio 4 and in Word of Mouth at 4 p.m, Michael Rosen talks to Lana Green, columnist at The Economist, about his new book, Talk on the Wild Side, The Untamable Nature of Language. This is followed at 4:30 p.m. by Great Lives, in which Christina Lam of the Sunday Times champions the life of former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto, in conversation with Matthew Paris. In this evening's concert on Radio 3 at 7 p.m, the Royal Northern Symphonia launches its 60th anniversary season with a birthday gala featuring works by Haydn, Mozart and Beethoven, plus tributes by Fauré, Poulet, Prokofiev and Brahms. The concert was recorded at Sage Gateshead on Sunday. This is followed by Free Thinking at 10 p.m. on Radio 3 and The Goodies. Comedy trio Tim Brooke-Taylor, Graham Garden and Bill Oddie talk to Matthew Sweet about their popular comedy series from the 60s and 70s.
We come now to Wednesday, 26 September. At 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 is a new series entitled Passport Paddy. Amid Brexit chaos, comedian Zoe Lowndes travels back to her Irish roots with her new Irish passport. What does it mean to belong somewhere, and will the motherland welcome her back? The drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is Brief Lives, the return of Tom Fry and Sharon Kelly's series about the Manchester legal representatives. Frank is roped in to help what he thinks is a community of retired people. But what have they retired from? Then at 8 p.m, also on Radio 4, is Decision Time, the next financial meltdown. 10 years on, Nick Robinson asks, could we cope with another financial crash? Repeated on Saturday at 10:15 p.m. Over on Classic FM at 8 p.m. is the Full Works Concert, in which Jane Jones presents an evening of music by Vaughan Williams to mark the 60th anniversary of his death. Or you may prefer to tune in to Radio 2 at 9 p.m. for Gregory Porter on Nat King Cole, as the award-winning singer-songwriter looks at the career of one of the giants of 20th century popular music. Porter also explores Cole's political activism.
To Thursday, 27th of September, and a new series of From Our Own Correspondent with Kate Adey at 11 a.m. on Radio 4. The afternoon concert at 2 p.m. on Radio 3 is Mozart's Don Giovanni with the chorus and orchestra of the Teatro Reggio in Turin. Comedy, tragedy and drama abound. Or you may prefer a different type of drama. Then tune in to The Princes and Princesses of Wales, the play on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m, when the peace of a Cardiff backyard is disturbed by new neighbours from the north of Wales. Two families must come to terms with their own attitudes. This is followed by Claire Boarding's Ramblings at 3 p.m. This week she walks the stretch of Centurion Way in Chichester as she hears the story of how walking helped a man recover from a brain injury. Repeated on Saturday at 6-7 a.m. Then at 8:30 p.m, also on Radio 4, In Business This Week investigates the influence of artificial intelligence on the retail sector. Finally, over to Radio 2 at 9 p.m. for a celebration of the French singer and actor Charles Dumont, who enjoyed modest success until a chance meeting with Edith Piaf. He created her signature recording, Je Ne Regrette Rien, and went on to write numerous songs for her before becoming a singer in his own right.
On to Friday, 28th of September, and at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 is The Eternal Life of the Instant Noodle. The Japanese believe that their best invention of the 20th century is instant noodles. Celebrating 60 years of astonishing success, Celia Hatton sees how the instant noodle went global with the help of students and travellers and has changed little since. At 2:15pm, the drama on Radio 4 today is The Gift. Carol is good at looking after vulnerable young mothers, but she's knocked off balance when Hayley turns up on her doorstep. This is followed at 8pm by Any Questions, this week from Weybridge in Surrey. Joining Jonathan Dimbleby is LBC broadcaster Ian Dale and co-leader of the Green Party, Sean Berry, repeated on Saturday at 1:10pm. Finally, a chance to catch up on the new and what will be the final series of Home Front, Radio 4's first World War drama. This week's omnibus edition is at 9pm on Radio 4.
And now, the next in our series of Community Matters interviews. Rob Pearman talks to Mike Foers, chairman of the Probus Club of St Albans.
I'm pleased to welcome to the studio today Mike Foers, who is chairman of Probus Club of St Albans. Now, Mike, many people would probably say, what is that?
It's a club that was formed originally for retired professional and businessmen, but now its remit is much wider so that it looks at people who are retired or semi-retired or about to retire. And it's intended to bridge the gap between having lots of contacts when you're working and then suddenly find that, like a tap being turned off, you are no longer in contact with people of a like mind to those that you've been associating with for many years.
And that's quite a significant thing, isn't it? For many people, when they do retire, they do find themselves that their reason for living, as it were, they used to get up and go to work every day, at least 5 days a week. And that goes, and it can be quite isolating, can't it?
It can, particularly in an area like St Albans, where a large number of people commute into London, and so they never get the opportunity to develop a network of friends, particularly if they've moved to the area with their work in later life and have not been able to use the opportunity to build up relationships when your children are attending school and you're going along with them.
PROME, it stands for professional, BUS is the beginning of the word business.
That's right.
So that was the origin of it.
The origin's a little bit before that. In 1965, the Rotary Club in Welwyn Garden City felt that as its membership was getting older, many of them couldn't keep pace with the demands of weekly attendance, perpetual fundraising. So they decided that for the older members of the club, they would set up an informal luncheon club that would meet less frequently and would be free of any of the obligations that were associated with Rotary. They called themselves the Campus Club. It was such a success that Rotary International circulated all the Rotary clubs, certainly in the UK, suggesting that other clubs might follow suit and set up similar informal luncheon clubs. The first club to do that was in Caterham, and there they coined the phrase Probus, first three letters of professional, first three letters business, Probus Club, and that was the birth of Probus. And the Campus Club, although it still retained its original Campus Club, I think, it's now the Probus Club of Welwyn Garden City Campus.
So you're born out of Rotary, which is, of course, much more widely known as a name. Remind me, is that for people who are still working?
Rotary was founded by two businessmen who found that they could pass business to each other, and eventually it developed in America. And so it was intended for middle managers, senior managers, so that it became an interchange of business ideas, business connections. But then as people got older, they stayed on in Rotary, and that's how it continued.
And therefore Probus comes in. What sort of age range?
Most of our members, I would think, start from 60, and I think our eldest member is 95. We are trying to appeal to more younger people, people I mentioned earlier, just retired or semi-retired, and are looking for something to fill the gap.
So it's a club. What do you do in the club?
We have lunch. It's a luncheon club primarily.
How often?
But we meet once a month, and after most most lunches, we have a speaker. Sometimes it may be one of the members who will give a talk about a holiday or something to do with their profession. But by and large, we invite people to come and talk to us on a very wide range of subjects. The last talk was by a man from Welwyn Garden City who had been approached with the idea of raising funds to adopt a school child in Kenya. He'd become so involved in it, he's now set up a charity, and the purpose of it is to sponsor a child through school. The speaker we had before that gave us a talk about Charles I, Pepys, the Fire of London and the plague, the interaction between the two. We've had policemen come to tell us about some of the humorous incidents that they encounter during their working life.
And you always have a speaker of some sort at your lunch?
Except when we have perhaps a special lunch or at the annual general meeting.
You're fortunate to be in an area where there are lots of people with specific knowledge.
And being near to London is an advantage. One speaker we had came from North London and he'd been a theatrical agent, and one of his stable had been the late Tommy Cooper. So he was able to give us an insight into what many people regard as one of the most funny men that we've had in this country.
Where do you meet for lunch?
We meet at Verulam Golf Club. We're not associated to the golf club, but when we have 60-odd members, so the potential of 60 people turning up for lunch, it needs somewhere that can accommodate us, and there aren't many places in St Albans that can do that.
Sure. Oh, you pay for the lunch, is that
yes,
how it works?
We have an annual subscription. It's a small amount, it's only £20, and then we pay for our lunches.
What else do you do apart from meet for lunch? I mean, that's obviously a key thing because you're a club. You're trying to bring people together who otherwise might be isolated. We don't know.
We've got a very active, we call it an events committee. And the members on that committee each have responsibility for some different aspect. We've got one gentleman who organises a monthly ramble. These are usually about 2.5-3 miles circular so that we can park our cars in a convenient place. And when we return to our cars, it's not too far to a local pub to have a meal. We have another man who organises regular visits to the theatre or to the opera. We're regular visitors to Milton Keynes, to the Glyndebourne and Welsh National Opera when they visit. And in fact, next month, there will be a busload of people going to see Don Giovanni. We've got a computer forum. One or two people, members of the club, spent their working lives dealing with computers of various kinds. And so they hold a session where other members can go along with problems, try and get them sorted out and learn how to make full use of their home computers. Only last week there was a visit to see Aladdin at the Brick Lane Theatre in London. Aladdin may seem as an unusual topic for a busload of geriatrics, but it was an adult version of Aladdin and it was well enjoyed by everyone who went. We try to engage all our members. Some of them are disabled, not as mobile as they would wish to be, but we try to keep in touch with them and involve them in all our activities. We offer to those who are seriously unwell, we make them honorary members, but we keep in touch with them. They get notified of all the events that we're putting on, and we have a newsletter which we send out to all of them and to the partners of any members who have passed on.
Okay, so apart from the lunches, and you've described the activities, you go out to various places, do you have any other activities during
the
year?
Yes, we do. We have a coffee morning each month. It's on the second Thursday of the month. Our lunches are on the last Thursday of each month. But it would be remiss of me not to mention that we do have an annual holiday. This year, it will be to Suffolk in May. Last year, it was to Bristol. The year before, it was to Ironbridge. So they're always to places of interest.
How's that organised? When you take
we've a member who has a contact with a coach company who see to all the logistics of the holiday. All that we have to do is to fill the coach.
And you've got 60 plus members.
We've got 60 plus members. We usually have a coach that holds about 50, 56, and it's usually full. Each day during the holiday, there are trips out to places of interest. We also have an affiliation to the Royal Horticultural Society, so we take advantage of that membership by visiting the RHS gardens at Wisley and Hyde Hall. And if we're up in Yorkshire, it would be to Harlow Carr, places like that.
But as you say, retirement is increasingly a sort of a 30-year stint. And that's a long time for people to stay retired. I mean, we don't work much more than that. No,
it is. I can't speak for other clubs, but the demographic of our club is at very top end of the age range. We desperately need to be able to attract younger people. By younger, I mean the ones who have just retired or are about to retire. Or semi-retired.
So you can only do this by trying to spread the word around. I mean, you go to the relevant events and wave the flag.
Yes, we just had an article published in the Marshallswick magazine. We're hoping to get more coverage in some of the local magazines as well as perhaps a little wider.
So you're keen to encourage the new retirees to get in touch.
We have just started a campaign. The article in the Marshallswick magazine was published this month. I wrote to Hertfordshire Life and that letter went in this month. You've kindly agreed to record this broadcast. We're then looking to distribute posters to churches, supermarkets, such like. And eventually, I hope that we shall get round to getting in touch with companies. We did try a similar exercise about 4 years ago. What we're trying to do this time is to sort of drip feed all the various bits of information so that instead of having a short, sharp campaign, this is something that will continue now for a few months.
Of course, that's what all charities and voluntary groups are trying to do because it is a problem. There's so many organisations, so many distractions, and I've spoken with many people running different groups of all sorts. The frustration is that people still don't know they exist.
Rotary is well established. It's over 100 years old, and because of the work that it does in the community with fundraising, it's often in the public eye. But Probus is not as outgoing as perhaps it should be, so it's very difficult for us to get any direct publicity. If we were involved with fundraising, making donations to charities, the press might be interested, but it's difficult for us to get any publicity.
When it was started, which for St Albans was in the 1984.
Yes. Okay.
And before that was the Well-In, which kicked it off. It was very much seen as an organisation for men. Let's face it, 50s, 60s, the majority of people in companies were still male rather than mixed.
That was the climate then. Right. Men were the prime movers in businesses. Rotary was created at a time when women weren't in employment. So it was a men only then. And it's something that is more historical than anything else.
That's right.
And so when Probus was started in 1965, it was established by a Rotary Club that was all men from an organisation that was still all men. It was only until the early 1990s, I think, that Rotary was challenged by ladies and they won admittance to Rotary Clubs. So the earliest start of ladies in Probus would have been from a similar date, the 1990s. Our club had been established in 1985, so it was then a men-only club. In fact, our newsletter still has as its heading, or it did have as its heading, St Albans Probus Club for Men.
Times are changing.
Lots of the members joined it when it was a men-only club. There are ladies' clubs. We have a ladies' club that's attached to us. It's not a full Probus club. They have lunches, but only quarterly. They have speakers. And when approached, they said the last thing that they wanted to do was to join with the men. Harpenden has a fully-fledged ladies-only club. They didn't want to join with the men, so they started their own Probus club. So ladies are in Probus.
One can appreciate that, and there is a very well-known international organisation, Sir Optimist International, which, again, is only women. I mean, that's a very well-established parallel, and I can understand why the genders like to keep apart sometimes. Do you think there will become a time when at least some of the meetings will be mixed?
I think it's inevitable that eventually there will. As younger people come in, they don't have the hang-up of the older ones who like being a men-only club. They're used to working along with colleagues who are ladies, which is something that the older generation perhaps didn't have.
The younger generations are not even aware of the issues that us oldies grapple with.
That's right.
But I mean, you know, there's that, I believe, at the last count, there's something like 1.2 million companies are run by women in this country.
Yes.
You don't have a central organisation that tells you what to do. No. You're independent.
We we're independent, totally independent. We can get guidance from a Probus association, but that central body simply issues news of in a magazine, news of local clubs. It doesn't control in any way the activities. It will give guidance and it will supply all the badges and stationery if needed to help to publicise Probus.
So it's a club for men with women associated?
It's a club for retired professional and business people. And how clubs organise their meetings is up to them. We choose, many others do, to have a lunch followed by a speaker. Some clubs, their activities cease there. We don't get involved in fundraising. Other clubs do. It's left entirely at the discretion of the membership. And as chairman, all I do is sit and organise the lunches and carry out the instructions of a committee.
And you very much would welcome new retirees to come and
bring in some fresh blood, yes.
Mike, thank you very much. I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Now, if you'd like to find out more about Probus, you're thinking perhaps you've retired or you're about to retire and you might want to join them locally in St Albans or indeed in Harpenden. There's a Probus Club in Harpenden as well. The website for the St Albans Probus Club, which will get you into the system, as it were, wherever you're living, is probusclubofstalbans.co.uk. Now, that's all one word. Remember, Probus is P-R-O-B-U-S. So it's probusclubofstalbans.co.uk. And there's a telephone number there for the membership secretary if you want to ring. That's 01727 854 266. 01727 854 266. And if you're interested in Probus clubs in other areas, such as Harpenden or even slightly further afield, then just go searching through Google under Probus and you'll find them.
And now, in concert, David Ireson tells Jill Burridge about some of the musical performances happening in the area in the next few weeks.
Hello, it's Jill Burridge back again as autumn takes its toll. Well, it doesn't take its toll, really. It's rather nice to be back into the sort of normal life, isn't it?
And yes.
David Ireson has joined me to look ahead to some of the musical concerts that we can enjoy coming weeks. So September, late September and October is really the run of dates that you've picked.
Yeah.
And we're starting off with the last Saturday in September, which is the 29th of September, and it's the Amadeus Chamber Orchestra, and they're at St Saviour's Church at Sandpit Lane. What are they doing?
Yes, St Albans' own chamber orchestra. They're starting their programme with Beethoven's overture, The Creatures of Prometheus. Now, this is a ballet which Beethoven wrote in 1801, which had 28 performances. It was obviously quite a popular piece when he wrote it. It was the only full-length ballet score he wrote. And they follow this with a violin concerto by Prokofiev, with Polina Makina as the soloist. Polina was born in Russia and studied at the Purcell School here in Hertfordshire and is then going to the Royal College of Music to start a scholarship just at the moment this month. Prokofiev wrote his second concerto for the violin in 1936, and it's rather more traditional than the first one and uses folk melodies and has a flavour of Spain and castanets in the third movement. Now, Malcolm Arnold, whose Serenade for Small Orchestra is also on the programme, is probably best known as the composer of the music for Bridge on the River Kwai, for which for which he won an Oscar. Mm. But he also wrote 9 symphonies and much, much chamber music. The main work of the evening is the Symphony No. 39 by Mozart. This is the first of the group of 3 symphonies, which were his last, the 3 last ones he wrote. Some scholars believe that the 3 were almost composed as a unified work. Anyway, whatever the circumstances of its composition, it's a wonderful symphony, full of typical Mozartian energy, vim and vigour. So here, to give you a flavour of it, is the start of the 4th and final movement.
So part of the final movement of Mozart's Symphony No. 39, which will be performed by the Amadeus Chamber Orchestra at St Saviour's Church, which is on Sandpit Lane. It starts at 7:30 on Saturday, the 29th of September. That sounds a really nice, varied programme.
It is, isn't it? Yes.
Some familiar, but some new to me.
Yes, I think I might do it myself.
Oh, yeah. Good idea. Yeah. So then on to the following Saturday, which is the 6th of October. Here we go into October. 7:30 again start for the Hearts Philharmonia. And again, at St Saviour's Church on Sandpit Lane. This is called A Night at the Ballet.
A Night at the Ballet, indeed. The Hearts Philharmonia are conducted by John Bezick and play music by Delibes, the Coppelia Suite, Rossini, La Boutique Fantastique, and this was orchestrated by Respighi. And, of course, no programme of ballet music would be complete without some music from Tchaikovsky. They're going to play the Swan Lake Suite. Now, in 1882, Tchaikovsky decided to do what Delibes had done before and make a concert suite out of the music that he had written for the ballet Swan Lake, because obviously to play the whole ballet would take far too long. Mm. So he made a concert suite out of the pieces. It lasts between sort of 20 minutes, half an hour, and I'm sure you recognise most of the beautiful melodies in it for which Tchaikovsky had such a gift. So here is a little taster of the start of the suite.
So that's part of Tchaikovsky's suite from Swan Lake, which forms part of the concert A Night at the Ballet, which will be performed at St Saviour's Church again on Sandpit Lane. The Hearts Philharmonia are performing, and the date to make a note of is Saturday the 6th of October at 7:30. The following evening, over in Hatfield, the de Havilland Philharmonic are performing in the Western Auditorium of the University of Hertfordshire. And they are doing Bernstein's, well, I say Bernstein, but some people say Bernstein, don't they?
I shall now say Bernstein, if I can remember.
It's his centenary concert. There are lots of sort of celebrations of Bernstein at the moment, aren't there?
There are. They start with the amazing Candide Overture, which is quite well known, and the lesser known but masterful Facsimile. And they finish their programme with the thrilling symphonic dances from West Side Story. Also in the concert, the winner of the Hatfield and District Music Festival of 2017, the clarinetist Raymond Bryan, joins the orchestra in a performance of Carl Nielsen's Clarinet Concerto. Now, Carl Nielsen, he heard the Copenhagen Wind Quintet rehearsing some music by Mozart in 1921 and was struck by the beauty of the sound of the group. He became very friendly with them and he wrote them a wind quintet. His intention was to write a concerto for each member of the ensemble, but he didn't quite manage to complete this project, only finishing a concerto for the flute and one for the clarinet. This was written when Nielsen was 63 and had achieved considerable fame throughout Scandinavia, but was disappointed that he was not better known further afield. It was a rather difficult time in his life. He was very worried about the unsettled state of the world. Things don't change, do they?
No.
And conscious of his own mortality. The soloist for whom it was written complained that Nielsen must be able to play the clarinet, as he had systematically used all the notes which were most difficult to play. Although the concerto had mixed reviews when it first appeared, it's become very well known and was actually selected as one of the three items chosen for a gala concert given in Copenhagen to celebrate the 150th anniversary of Nielsen's birth. Now, the concert also includes another piece of American music. It's called The Unanswered Question by Charles Ives. Now, since the Bernstein music is fairly well known, I thought you might like to know a little something about the Ives piece. It's rather unusual. It's scored for three groups of musicians, a string group, a solo trumpeter, and a woodwind quartet, who all play their own music quite independently and are sometimes placed in such a way that they cannot even see each other. So the strings sometimes playing off stage. So how you conduct such a piece, I have no idea at all. Anyway, he first wrote the piece in 1908, and revised it between 1930 and 1935, and it was first performed in 1946 at the Juilliard School in New York. Ives provided a short text to help interpretation of the work, giving it a narrative as if it was programme music. Throughout the piece, the strings play slow tonal chords that, according to Ives, represent the silence of the Druids, who see, hear and know nothing. Against this background, the solo trumpet has a theme which is repeated seven times, the perennial question of existence, to which the woodwind quartet answers, the first six times in an increasingly erratic way. Ives wrote that the woodwinds answer represent the fighting answerers who after a time realise the futility and begin to mock the question before finally disappearing, leaving the question to be asked one more time before the silences are left to their undisturbed solitude. Now, this may strike you as a very 20th century piece of cod philosophy, but actually it is rather an interesting piece of music, and it's a fascinating glimpse into the sound world of that particular time, and it's actually only about 6 minutes long. So it's part of, you know, a fantastic programme. It's a really interesting short piece, but it won't detract from a very long and exciting programme by that great 20th century giant of the musical world, Leonard Bernstein.
No. Oh. Golly. Well, so, I mean, the unanswered question is only 6 minutes long.
Yes, it is.
Golly. The questions well, it raises would take indeed. A heck of a lot longer to sort out.
Indeed, that says something about it.
My goodness, it? Lovely. Okay, so shall we hear a little bit of the Bernstein?
What a good idea.
Part of the symphonic dances from West Side Story. I have to say that's a great favourite of mine. All those tunes in West Side Story, they're fantastic, aren't
they? Did you hear the prom performance?
I didn't, no. I must go back and have a listen before they disappear off iPlayer.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very good. Right, so then the following Saturday you are actually conducting the Carillon Chamber Choir at St Peter's Church this time, just on the roundabout at the top of the High Street in St Albans, and Saturday the 13th of October, 7:30. So what are you performing?
Well, the focus of this weekend seems to be on Russian music, because we're doing Rachmaninoff's Great Vespers, and if you prefer orchestral music, then St Saviour's Church has a mostly Russian concert by the St Albans Symphony Orchestra. They're playing two great works by Shostakovich, the Cello Concerto and the Symphony No. 5. Say something about that, their concert first. It starts off with Malcolm Arnold's Peterloo Overture. Malcolm Arnold, you remember I mentioned before. Mm. Peterloo was the derisive name given to the incident in Manchester in August 1819 when a massive but orderly crowd met to hear a speech on political reform. On the order of the magistrate, the cavalry was sent in to seize the banners and arrest the speaker, who was a man called Henry Hunt. And in the ensuing panic, 11 people died and about 400 people were injured. So the overture attempts to portray these events musically, and after a lament for the dead, it ends in triumph, in the firm belief that those who have suffered and died in the cause of unity among mankind will not have died in vain. So now the Shostakovich. Shostakovich was a stunningly original composer, but did suffer some political intervention, if you could describe it like that, but was a great Russian patriot. He wrote the Cello Concerto in 1959 for his great friend Rostropovich, who, it said, memorised it in an amazing 4 days and gave the premiere performance in the Leningrad Conservatory. It was later recorded in Moscow. It's regarded as one of the most difficult works for the cello, and the opening four-note theme, based on DSCH, which is sort of Dmitri Shostakovich's motif. Mm. I remember Guy Johnson playing it in the final of the BBC Young Musician of the Year competition, and I remember the performance, I should remember it because it was a brilliant performance, but I remember it because a string broke, which is doesn't happen very often, but is memorable when it does.
Yes.
Anyway, nothing daunted, he went on to win the competition.
Brilliant.
The soloist on this occasion is a man called Matthew Sharp, who has an amazingly varied career: cellist, singer, writer, composer and director. He teaches the cello at the Birmingham Conservatoire and is a most engaging character. Now, Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony was written and first performed also in Leningrad, where it was a huge success and apparently received an ovation which apparently lasted more than half an hour. never let it be said that the Russians are not passionate about their music.
No, goodness me.
Now, you may be interested to know that Shostakovich included a quote from the Habanera from Bizet's Carmen in the first movement, apparently because he had had an infatuation with a woman who had refused his offer of marriage and had gone off to Spain. So there's a little quote from Bizet in the first movement. Anyway, the symphony managed to score a big hit both with the public and the critics, and has always been one of Shostakovich's most popular pieces. So a wonderful programme this, of music by Malcolm Arnold and Shostakovich. Now, if you prefer choral music on the same night, at St. Peter's on the same night, there is a performance of Rachmaninoff's Great Vespers, or the All-Night Vigil, to give it its proper title. Music for the Orthodox Church is exclusively vocal. There is no instrumental music of any kind. And the music for the Orthodox Church was at its height at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th centuries, with people like Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky, Gretchaninoff, Kalinnikov.
So it's completely unaccompanied, is it?
Completely unaccompanied, yeah. Now, incredibly, the Vespers was written in the space of 2 weeks in 1915. Rachmaninoff at the time was on tour with Koussevitzky, giving concerts all over Russia to raise funds for the war with Germany. He himself was not a regular churchgoer, but he was 41 and at the height of his powers and had fairly recently completed another religious work, the Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. The first performance also was not liturgical, but was given by the Moscow Synodal Choir. It was very well received and had several more performances until, of course, all religious music stopped with the revolution in 1917. Mm. It was then recorded in Moscow in the 60s, and then, of course, it started to become very popular again. When the conductor first saw the score, Rachmaninoff took it to him and played it through on the piano. He was absolutely amazed at the depth of the bass part, and he said to Rachmaninoff, "Where on earth are we going to find bassists who can sing this music? They're as rare as asparagus at Christmas." Rachmaninoff, however, was confident that he could, in Russia, find voices to sing it, which indeed he did, of course.
And do you find it hard to find
voices? It is. You definitely need some very low basses for some of the music, yes.
Oh, right.
You train them on vodka and cigars and stuff. Yes. The All-Night Vigil was celebrated on the eve of major festivals in the Orthodox Church and consisted of three services: Great Vespers, Matins, which was sung at midnight, and Prime, which is the first hour. It started at 6 o'clock in the evening on Saturday night and finished at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Oh.
Hence it's called the All-Night Vigil.
Oh, right.
By the end of the 19th century, it was down to a mere 3 hours. The full service consisted of hymns, readings, chant, prayers, and the music, of course, was a vehicle for the sacred texts, whose importance was paramount. Now, Rachmaninoff, of course, is probably best known as a pianist, so I thought it would be great to have some of his piano music played. We are very fortunate to have St. Albans' own Alyssa Fiersova to come and play for us. She will play music by Rachmaninoff and a piece of her own called Lune Rouge. She's an amazingly talented musician, for as well as being an internationally known pianist, she's about to give a recital in the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, she is a conductor and a composer. And Carillon sang a piece of hers last year, her setting of the Stabat Mater, and so we're going to do that piece again so the audience will have another chance to hear it. Also in the first half of the concert, we're singing music The Cherubic Hymn by Gretchaninoff, a sacred concerto by Rachmaninoff, and a short piece by Kalinnikov. These are all atmospherically Russian pieces and set the scene beautifully for the Vespers, which forms the second half of the concert and will be sung in front of the high altar. The church will be lit by candlelight, and to complete the atmosphere, we will have icons displayed, which have been kindly lent to us by their creator, Derek Bird. Some of our listeners may know about Derek Bird. He was a GP in Harpenden for many years. But he has spent many years of his life writing icons. You write them, apparently. You don't paint them. That's the correct term.
I didn't know that.
You write icons. Mm. So we will hope to create a setting worthy of this great Russian masterpiece, the Vespers, for the second half. An opportunity, too, to come and hear Alyssa Fiersova, both as a composer and a pianist. So I hope it will be a memorable experience.
It certainly sounds it.
So here's just the very beginning of the Rachmaninoff Vespers.
little taster of the Rachmaninoff Vespers. And I'll just go through the details of both those concerts that are, they're both on Saturday the 13th of October, and they both start at 7:30. So you can either be at St. Peter's Church, where David will be conducting the Carillon Chamber Choir with choral music, and Alison Furseva as well doing her piano. And then the other concert is at St. Saviour's Church, and that's the, again, a Russian theme, but Shostakovich cello and his Symphony No. 5 at St. Saviour's Church on Sandpit Lane, again, 7:30. So a choice of concerts that evening.
Indeed, choral or orchestral.
Yes, very much
both
so.
Both Russian.
And lastly, for our preview of concerts this time around, we head the following night, so Sunday the 14th of October, and a 7 o'clock start, not 7:30, 7 o'clock, Welwyn Garden City Orchestra are going to be performing in the Tithe Barn at Tewinbury Farm Hotel.
Yeah, they're playing music by Bartok, Glazunov's Violin Concerto, Gounod's Symphony No. 2, and Eric Sarti's wonderful Gymnopédie, with which we will leave you to whet your appetite for a month of fascinating music covering everything from Mozart to Malcolm Arnold, ballet, Bernstein, and Russian music for the Orthodox Church and the concert hall.
Wonderful. I must say, doing these sort of previews of all the concerts that are going on locally, it just reminds me every time of the wealth of music that we have available.
We are very, very lucky.
We are indeed.
Yes. It makes me want to go to them all as well.
Yes, I'm sure. Well, you could do the interval of your concert and you could rip along to Sandpit Lane. Anyway, David, Alison, thank you very much for joining me and going through what sounds a really interesting list of concerts that are coming up during late September and October. We'll be back again in a month or so to look ahead again.
Indeed. Thank you, Jill.
Finally, we have our piece of music, Forgotten Blues, by Gothby in its entirety. Many thanks to all our readers today, to Lizanne for her editorial assistance, and to Monty and John, who make all the copies of the programme and arrange to get yours to you. And we will be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra in September 2018. Goodbye.